Good morning. So, last time, mentioned we were going to look at, last time we looked at stalling for our control hazard. We said control hazards were cases where we couldn't figure out what instruction we were supposed to fetch in time with a normal operation of our pipeline. You know, so we had usually solved the problem of figuring out what instruction to fetch by computing it in the fetch stage, but sometimes we need information that hasn't been computed yet. And one solution for this would be to stall. We stall what for stalling for conditional jump or return would look like. And we're going to end up doing that stalling for return in our processor design. And we're not going to actually do that stalling for conditional jump. And the reason why is we have a better technique that we're going to implement, which is called branch prediction. And the idea of branch prediction is that we're going to guess where the conditional jump will go, and guessing is fairly simple because, well, there's two possibilities, and we can make a guess which is at least as likely as a coin flip to be right pretty easily. And the guess we chose to make is that we just chose to say it always goes to the target. We could make some other guesses. There can be a lot more sophisticated about that. But we make some sort of guess, and if we're wrong, we undo our guess instructions. And if not, we do nothing. We just execute the jump in 1 second. And a trick we had is that it turned out the way our pipeline works, that undoing is not actually a very complicated operation, because by the time we figure out what the actual outcome of the jump is, it hasn't really done very much. So we can undo it by just clearing out its pipeline registers. Then we talk about actually implementing stalling and squashing. So we sort of talked about what stalling and squashing look like as far as pipeline diagrams, like what's in what cycle. But we were going to actually need to implement the control logic for that. And the most likely way we're going to do it is we're going to have some signals that do write-disable on pipeline registers and reset on pipeline registers. Our write-disable signal is named stall in HTLRS, and our reset signal is named bubble. And when we set the stall signal, we keep those pipeline registers outputting the same thing they used to be outputting, because we're not writing a new value into them. When we set the bubble signal, we're having them output the default values, and our default values are going to correspond to a no-op. And we're going to implement logic that sets these by probably looking at the I codes in our pipeline, because we can check pretty directly, is there a return in the execute stage? Because, well, we have pipeline registers that go into the execute stage, and those pipeline registers probably store the I code of the instruction. We can look at that I code and say, is there a return there? And we can use that kind of information to decide, do I want to set one of these stall or bubble signals to change what the pipeline registers do from their normal operation? We also mentioned that our conventional operation of stalling involves both the stall and bubble signals. So this is a case where I think our textbook probably chose the wrong names, because a lot of people not unreasonably say, okay, we need to stall the instruction in decode, so I'm just going to set stall for decode and we're done, right? And that's not how it works. And maybe it would have been better for them to call them write, disable, and reset. So if we think of this example here, I have an MR move queue, goes through its stages normally, MI add, needs to repeat its decode stage. If we think of this cycle here, you know, this boundary here between two cycles, I should say, where we need to make that stalling decision, what's happening is our add is staying in decode, and our MR is moving from execute to memory, and we have a NOP going into the execute stage. So to make that happen, we're going to need to stall decode and set the bubble for the execute stage to insert that NOP. If we don't set the bubble for the execute stage, we'd end up with two copies of the add. That's probably not going to execute in a very nice way. Okay, some questions about things we covered last time? So we've gone all over implementing our pipeline logic for conditional jumps and returns. There's a piece we're missing, which is implementing the logic for the program counter. And that has to be different from the logic we've seen before because things are happening with different pipeline registers. So I'm going to show you how our textbook has decided to present this logic. So we have our normal case for setting the PC, where we just take our PC, we add the instruction length, with it, of course, you know, we are going to actually compute that using information from the instruction memory that I just haven't drawn here. And that's our new PC. We also have the case where we get an immediate value from the instruction and use that to set the PC. This is call jump and our prediction for conditional jumps. And so, well, so far here, we're all things that you've done in HTLFlow. Now we have new case where we need to repeat the previous PC for stalls for a load use hazard, halt, or return. Here I've drawn them using the same mucks as everything else. You could also potentially use the stall built-in signal, though I don't actually recommend it because of what we're going to add later. So that's our first new case. So this is when, for example, that add instruction state in decode, our fetch stage needs to fetch the same thing. We don't want to skip an instruction, because the thing in fetch is not going to go to decode. So then we have to deal with misprediction. So in the case where we had a misprediction, and now we know our result of our conditional jump, we want to correct it. And our textbook has chosen that we're going to do this correction during the fetch stage of the instruction that we are actually running based on the jump. They could have also done this with the other mucks, and I think that would have been more logical, but they chose to do it here. It works as long as we make sure we get the signal from the correct stage. So in this case, we're going to get the signal from the memory stage after the jump has examined the condition codes. If we were getting it to over here, we would get it from the execute stage. We just need to be careful that we're consistent, that we are actually getting it from the jump, where the jump is at that time. In this case, that time is, you know, the cycle where we went to fetch the new instruction, not the cycle before. And similarly, the textbook handles the case of getting the address for return in the same way. And note that in this process, our textbook is named PC to predicted PC. So the register we have, rather than actually holding the actual program counter we're going to use, it holds the prediction. The actual program counter we're going to use, if you want that, that is here, not before it. And also note that when we want to feed back the same value, the value to repeat it, we want to feed back the value from after this mux, not before it. Because we want to fetch the same thing we fetched before, we want to choose the thing we're actually fetching, not the thing that was not corrected for jumps or returns. Okay, so we have these signals. Let's think about where they come from. So our immediate value comes from the instruction memory. So we're getting that. It's going to be used the next cycle. Our return address from return, since we want the return to have finished its memory stage, it's going to come from the registers coming out into writeback, because that's the time at which we're going to actually use this information in our fetch stage. So that's going to come from the memory to writeback registers. Our next PC for the conditional jump is going to come from the execute to memory writeback registers, because the jump will have finished execute to evaluate the condition codes, and then now it's in the memory stage, and we're using its values to figure out what to fetch. questions about this logic? Yes. Can I say the difference between 3 and 5 in regards to return? Sure. So when we're doing a return, the first thing we do is we say, gosh, I don't know where we're returning to. That case is going to be handled with 3, with this loop back here. And we're going to do that for 3 cycles. And then we'll finally know where we're returning to once the return has made it to the write back stage. And in that case, we will finally use this case 5, which will be handled via here, getting it from the returns write back registers. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so I probably, if I were writing the textbook, probably I would have made this logic all happen in the previous cycle, like this, where everything is going into a PC register, but that's not what our textbook authors chose. So they chose to instead, you know, move this mux here afterwards. Like, and in the homeworks, you can do either, but if I'm showing you sort of as a primary diagram what the textbook does, so when you read the textbook, you aren't confused about what's going on. Other questions? Okay, so after we've done all this work, where are we going to actually stall? So the only places we have left where we're going to stall are when the memory output's needed in fetch. This is the return case. So this is return. And when the memory output's needed to execute, which is lrmove q or pop, because these are both the instructions that read from memory, followed by some use in the execute stage of the value that was run. And if we think about, can we do better than this? Well, for this second case, it seems like this is very difficult. For this first case, we're not going to do it, but you could do better. You could do branch prediction for this case, which some real processors do. You might say, how would I guess where the return address is? And the typical way processors do this is they have a little bit of storage for recent return addresses that were produced by clock. So you can actually, you know, fix the memory, the return stall, but it involves some stuff we're not going to do. And real processors do it by storing, when there's calls, what the return address was. So overall, we have our 5-stage pipeline where we repeat one instruction every cycle, except for hazards, and our main hazard is what we call the load use hazard. That's loading a value from memory. This is memory to execute sort of dependency. We have a hazard from conditional jumps where sometimes we mispredict and take 2 cycles. And we have a hazard from return, which happens in all cases because we decided not to try to implement some sort of prediction for return. So we have a fairly complete processor. And there's some things that we're going to talk about later in the semester that we're going to add onto the processor. And I'm going to sort of give motivation for some things we're going to do, you know, as a sort of next few topics. So one thing that we've kind of glossed over when we talked about this processor, we said we have a data and instruction memory, and they each, you know, finish reads and writes in 1 cycle. And we mentioned at the beginning of the semester that that's not really how memory works. That really, they take lots of cycles. And we have this ideal case that we're dealing with where they're single cycle, And we can approximate that pretty well with caches, which is going to be our next big topic. But caches, you know, they work a lot of the time, so we'll actually end up with that sort of single cycle style performance like over 90% of the time. But sometimes we'll have much slower performance. So in particular, we'll have cache hits where we get that single cycle performance, or we'll have cache misses where it's slower. And here I'm saying it only takes 5 cycles. That might be unrealistically low for like a full cache miss. Could be hundreds of cycles potentially. Sometimes it's only 5, depends on details we'll talk about over the next week or two. And this second case here is something that, well, we're gonna try to deal with it by designing our caches to have it happen left often. That's gonna be our next topic. But processors are also gonna try to deal with this by having different ways we figure out what instructions to run. So there are 2 things we do in addition to pipelining to run more instructions at a time on sort of a modern desktop or mobile phone processor or laptop processor. So one of them is multiple issue. So by issue, I mean starting instructions. So something we can do instead of just starting one instruction at a time is we can start multiple instructions at a time. Now, you might say, wait a moment, if I write like add into R8, we can't start those both at the same, run those both at exactly the same time because I can't like use one's result for the other. And yes, we can't do that. But if we have independent instructions or sufficiently independent instructions, we can run them at the same time. And this is one thing processors do. To do this, we're gonna need to like have multiple ALUs. We're gonna need to have like a cache for data instruction memory that support multiple accesses at a time potentially. And the hazard handling gets much more complicated. Like if you think of implementing forwarding being confusing now let's add twice as many instructions in the big amount. So this is one thing we can do. But this still seems pretty bad in the case where we have these long memory accesses. Like in the cases where we don't, it seems fine. But in cases where we do, it seems pretty bad. So another thing that sort of modern processors are often designed to do is run instructions other than in the program order. And we're going to talk about this in a lot more detail later. We're not going to implement it because it actually involves a lot of complicated things to implement. We're going to talk about sort of at a high level what the logic for this works. But the basic idea is that if we have some sort of slow instruction that other instructions depend on, we're not going to just stall those other instructions. We're going to find some instructions that are independent. So in this case, we have this load into R8, and then we have these instructions that don't care about R8. We can just run them right away. And this is something that processors are designed to do. And you know, it has the advantage that when we have these slow memory accesses, we can kind of hide that. And this is something that we can do even when, you know, the assembly writer or compiler couldn't plan about exactly which memory reads would be slow. Now, I'm saying the processor runs things out of order. It needs to provide the illusion it's done in order. So when we're implementing this design, we're going to need to make sure that if I have an instruction that uses R9, that I don't run it before the subtract actually computes the value of R9. You know, that's a hazard I would need to handle. And obviously, the hazard handling gets a lot more complicated if we're changing the order in which things run. So we'll talk a lot more about that later in the semester when we give sort of a high-level overview of a strategy for implementing this. But these are things sort of that, in addition to pipelining, that processors do to find, get more instructions to run at once, you know, and try to get like multiple instructions started every second. So questions about sort of our very high level overview of multiple issue and out of order execution? Yes. What does the C stand for? Commit. So in the typical implementation of these designs, we have an extra stage to actually do the bookkeeping for finishing up the instruction. We'll talk about what that really entails a little bit in several weeks. Other questions? Okay. So we talked a bunch about implementing pipelining and hazard handling, and we gave a preview of some like really fancy ways of avoiding hazards, or at least kind of avoiding hazards, making it so we can do more things. And sort of an overall point of view I want to point out is that, go back to where we introduced pipelining. When we talked about pipelining initially, we talked about throughput and latency. We kind of glossed over latency a bit. We've always been counting cycles. But one thing to note about latency is that sort of a way latency shows up practically with our hazard handling is that when we've had hazards that are hard to handle, we've had to waste cycles. And that's where we're kind of seeing the latency, because the amount of cycles we have to wait depends on, you know, it's kind of reflecting the latency of the instruction rate, because it's going to be bounded by how many cycles the instruction takes, not how long each cycle is. And so we generally, with a larger pipeline, our hazard handling is likely to have higher penalties. And this has meant that some processors have like sort of miscalculated, some process designers famously have sort of miscalculated this cost, or have found scenarios where you have a processor with a faster clock cycle, but it's not actually practically faster. So a famous example was the early versions of the Pentium 4. So when Intel was designing the Pentium 4, the rage in marketing processors at the time was having the higher clock rates. Because processors were really marketed on clock rates. And Intel tried really hard to have a really, really high clock rate. And so their new processor design to do this had 2 to 3 times the number of pipeline stages of everything else on the market. But they didn't actually get the clock rate as high as they hoped to. And this meant that even though they had a high clock rate processor with lots of pipeline stages, which also did all that out of order and multiple issue stuff we just glossed over, it turned out that even though it theoretically it could run some programs a lot faster, that the reviews said things like here, for today's buyer, the Pentium 4 simply doesn't make sense. It's slower than the competition in just about every area. Like on every benchmark they were running, it just wasn't faster even though it had a much higher clock rate because of all the hazards of this much longer pipeline. And the reason why Intel didn't anticipate this is that when they were designing it, they assumed that the clock rate would get not like 50% higher, but like 100% higher, which they didn't achieve in their first few versions of this processor. Okay, so questions about our pipelining related topics. So as I mentioned, our main topic for today, or next topic rather, will be caching. So we're gonna move beyond the model of we have one cycle per access, and we're gonna kind of acknowledge the reality we started with at the beginning of the semester that, oh, the memory's on a different chip, so how does that work? And our solution is that we're gonna keep parts of the memory on our processor, which we're going to call a cache, and those parts can be accessed really quickly. We can actually do those in one cycle or some small amount of time. And our hope is we always use that copy. Now the problem is that copy is much smaller. So this can't possibly actually be true that we're always going to use the copy. But we're going to get surprisingly close. So to talk about what caches look like in practice, I'm going to look at an old CPU. So this is from 2004. Why is it from 2004? Because it's a single core processor, so I don't have to point out multiple cores. And because someone went through the work of figuring out where most of the components were, which often doesn't happen on more modern processors. So on these processors, I've highlighted in red the approximate location where people think the registers are, register files are. This processor has two register files, one for floating point, one for non-floating point. Okay, so that's the register files. The register files are actually stored next to our floating point ALU and our arithmetic ALUs. Here are the data and instruction cache. So this is called the L1 or level one cache. And this is what stands in our processor as the instruction memory and the data memory. So that's where they are. So these are much bigger than the register files because they're cached, they store some data. Then we have here the level two cache. So more than half of this processor space is devoted to caches, like the physical space on the chip devoted to actually just storing these copies of data for memory is not only substantially larger than our register space, it's substantially larger than the space for the ALUs, which this processor has multiple of, or the floating point ALU, and the floating point ALU put together. Like way, way larger. And substantially larger than sort of all the fetch and decode logic. And this is typical. So typically, if you look at a physical processor, most of the space on the processor is devoted to caches. And this is an old processor. So at the time, sort of the optimal design ended up with a level one set of level one caches. And as is typically the case with those, we have a separate one for instructions and data and a level two cache. On a more modern processor, we might have a level three cache. We would usually have a level three cache. That seems to be the consensus design for many modern processors. Not always. Have a third level of cache in addition. We'll talk later on about why would it make sense to have multiple levels of cache. Like what's the performance benefit? And we have these sort of progressively bigger pieces of data storage here. We have our registers, we have a bigger space for these level one caches, we have a bigger level two cache, and off the chip somewhere, we have this huge main memory. And they get bigger, they also get slower. So our registers, a typical access is going to take like around a cycle, so it's less than a nanosecond. For the L1 cache, typical access time is order a nanosecond. So we've kind of talked about the cache taking one cycle. It's relatively common that an L1 cache will take a couple cycles, like three cycles to do the access, but it can do multiple in parallel. So you can start one every cycle and they're pipelined. But it will take longer in latency than accessing registers typically. The L2 cache, a typical time might be on the order of 5 nanoseconds. And L3, for processors which have them, a typical time might be in the order of 20. And then main memory can be like 50 to 100. These are very approximate numbers because there's a lot of variation. But we typically do get this sort of order of magnitude as we go down the hierarchy increases. Which means we really, really want our accesses to stay on top. But the problem is that if we stay up here, we don't actually have much space. That these level one caches are going to be tens of kilobytes. The level twos are typically going to be hundreds of kilobytes, maybe a megabyte. Level threes are going to be megabytes. And that's, if our program uses a gigabyte of storage, that's not going to fit in there. There's no way. It's not possible. So questions about this sort of overall arrangement. So we have these L1 caches. And these L1 caches are our data and instruction memories. So we're going to put in an address. We're going to put in an input if we're doing writing. We're going to have some sort of write enable signal. We're going to get a value. So everything so far looks like our data memory. We're also going to have some sort of signal saying when a value is ready. We need that something like that because, we have to make it so we can handle it taking one cycle sometimes and longer other times. And the typical designs, this L1 cache is going to be responsible for talking to the next level of cache, and the next level of cache is going to be responsible for talking to the memory. So if we're making the processor itself, all we're talking to is the caches. We're not actually talking to memory directly. The caches will talk to memory for us. So the way this might work out is my processor, I'm going to talk to the cache. I'm going to ask, say, to read a few values. And sometimes the cache is going to have those values, and sometimes it's not. So in this example, address ABCD, the cache didn't have, so it talked to the next level, which was, and it got that and sent it back to the CPU. When I asked for address 1234, the cache apparently had it, so it didn't need to talk to the next level. Some questions about this sort of interface the cache is going to provide the CPU. Okay. So when we're setting up these caches, our goal is that we're going to want to provide the performance of our fastest memory. So these L1 caches performance for accessing things they're storing. So that sort of 1 nanosecond type performance with the capacity of the largest memory. And obviously this is not actually possible, right? We can't actually provide both of these, but we want to get as close to these as possible. We want to appear to have the capacity of all memory and appear to have the performance of our fast small memory. And to have that performance, we want to hide the sort of 100 times latency difference, right? If we looked at our diagram, we have this 100x gap between the approximate level one performance and main memory. And to do that, we want to basically have about 99% of our accesses only use the caches, possibly more, so they take about 1 nanosecond. So those 1% of the time where it takes 100 nanoseconds isn't very significant. We want really, really high rate of finding things in the cache. And this seems like at conflict with this idea that the cache is going to still present us with the big memory. So how is that going to be possible? And in general, it's not, right? I can certainly try to access memory in a way where it's not possible to achieve performance that's similar to our fastest memory, but good capacity. But real programs are more constrained. There's two properties that real programs have that we're going to take advantage of. So one of them is what we're going to call temporal locality. That if I access a value in a typical program I write, I'm very likely to access it again soon. And caches can take advantage of this by keeping recently accessed values stored. So those values I'm more likely to access than some random value elsewhere in memory. And by storing those values, they can make it more likely that we'll access the values quickly than slowly. Another property real programs have is called spatial locality. If I access a value, I'm likely to access a value at a nearby address. So catchers can take advantage of this by not loading one value when I access it, by loading a whole bunch of values. And it turns out that when I talked about it taking 100 nanoseconds to access memory, that's latency. But I can access at roughly the same speed, not completely the same speed, but roughly the same speed if I'm accessing a bunch of stuff from memory as one thing. So, like, I can access, like, 128 bytes from memory about as fast as I can access one byte. So it's not exactly as fast, obviously, but it's close. So a way I can take advantage of that is I can store lots of adjacent values even if the program doesn't explicitly ask for them. So these are things that we're going to assume about programs we run, and they are usually true. And they're usually true without us needing to actually make our programs have these properties. We don't need to modify our programs. This is just, if I take a program someone else wrote, not thinking about these, it's going to typically have both of these properties be true. And to illustrate that, let's look at some code here. So here I have a function, compute mean. It computes the mean of an array and returns that mean. And we have great examples of temporal and spatial locality in this code. So we have temporal locality in the machine code for this loop. The instructions that make up this loop, they're going to be fetched lots and lots of times. So that's an opportunity for our cache to have lots of cases where it has a copy of those values stored. And so it can access them really quickly. We also have good spatial locality in the machine code for most of this, because generally, if we're executing an instruction at address 1,000, the next instruction is going to likely to be just after it. So most of our instructions are next to each other, not always, but mostly. And so that's another way we can make sure that we're always accessing a fast copy, not almost always accessing a fast copy. If we look at our data, the variables total, I, and length, if they aren't stored in registers, if they have to be stored in memory, they're going to have, you know, they're going to be accessed over and over again. If they're stored in registers, they're also going to be accessed over and over again, but it won't matter for the cache. So they have great temporal locality. They're accessed repeatedly. And we have good spatial locality in the array values. We always access the next thing in values, which is at the next address after the previous thing. That's another thing our caches can take advantage of. By, if we cache bunches of the values array together, we can have sort of the benefits of having those fast accesses. So this is examples of spatial and temporal locality, and I didn't really try, and it just comes up all the time in real code that your code will have these patterns that have good spatial and temporal locality. And because of that, we can make caches that, for typical real programs, actually achieve something approximating that high performance without making it seem like you're restricting yourself to only accessing a small amount of data. Like, as far as you're doing, writing your program, you're just accessing memory like you normally do, using as much memory as you like, but you're obeying these locality properties, so the cache is going to make your memory seem really fast. Questions about locality? Okay, so we know sort of what our cache is taking advantage of. Let's go through the details and talk about building a possible cache. And I'm going to talk about a typical simple cache organization. We're going to make it a little more complicated later. And I'm going to start by saying, okay, I want to build a cache, and I need to decide how much stuff my cache is going to store. In this case, I'm going to choose to store 16 bytes. And because we want spatial locality, I don't want to store just one byte at a time. I know that usually my program is going to access things that are next to each other. So I want to store blocks that are more than one byte. In this case, I've chosen to have those blocks be 2 bytes. probably 2 bytes is a little small for real programs, but also 16 bytes is a little small for real caches. So we're going to deal with a nice small size. But I want more than 1 byte at a time, because I know that because of spatial locality, if a program accesses this byte, we probably should also store this byte, because it's likely to use it too. So I have 16 bytes I reserved that I've grouped up into 4 blocks. Did I do this, count this wrong? No. 8 bytes that I've grouped up into 4. Yes, okay. Counting. So I have 8 bytes I've grouped up into 2 4 blocks. So that's going to be a cache I'm going to want to store down. And I can't just say, here's my cache, I have 4 blocks of stuff. I need to have some way of knowing that if the program is trying to access, say, this byte of memory, where I would find it in my cache. I need to know where to look. I can't just say it's somewhere, I just don't know what's stored in that cache yet. So I'm going to need some extra information about how I'm laying out this cache. So let's say to start out that I'm reading this address. So I'm reading this address 01011. So if we look at our table of memory here, that is this BB here. So I want to figure out where that would be in the cache. And to do that, I need to know, well, I have these 4 blocks of my cache. How are they used? And for this cache design, a choice I'm going to make is I'm going to assign each of the blocks an index, and I'm going to say that each of these blocks can only store certain parts of memory. So I'm going to say that my first block, I'm going to say, has index 0, and it can store either the first 2 bytes of memory, or the fourth 2 bytes, or the 8th 2 bytes, and so on. So basically, I'm just dividing up memory between the cache blocks. So I'm saying I have 4 cache blocks, a quarter of memory can go to the first one, another quarter can go to the second one, another quarter can go to the third one, and so on. And I'm doing it in this interleaved way. Partly, one way of thinking about why I want to do it in this interleaved way is when we think of storing like an array, we'd like to be able to have the whole array in our cache, if possible. That's only possible if I have this sort of interleaved way. Because an array would be something we might want to cache together, that spatial locality, we want to take advantage of that. And similarly, my second block can be stored at 1, 5, 9, and so on. The first, the second, the fifth, the ninth, and so on. Or second, sixth, ninth, yeah. So it can be, so we're just alternating how they're allocated. So our first block, every 4, starting with the first one. Our second block, every 4, starting with the second one. Our third block, every 4, starting with the third one, and so on. And the way this mapping works out, the reason I've highlighted these 2 bits here, is that it turns out, because I've chosen a power of 2 for the number of blocks I have, that I can figure out where does index 01 go by looking for things that have 01 in those bits of their memory address. Which is very convenient, because I'm going to need to implement this in hardware, and I'd sure like not to do division to figure out where things go, and it turns out I don't need to. I can just, because I've chosen a power of 2 size for my block, I can just strip off the last bit to figure out sort of the number of the block I'm in memory, and then I can look at the lower bits, because I've chosen a power of 2 number of blocks, just to figure out which group it's in. Is it in the first group, the second group, third group, or fourth group? That's exactly how our cache is going to work in hardware. And this arrangement is known as a direct map cache. So each block, you know, is assigned to a set of things in memory which are spaced by how many blocks we have. And note that I've divided up memory into these blocks. I haven't decided, and I've always decided that blocks of memory start at an even address. Because, I started with the beginning of memory. I'm not gonna start in the middle of memory to figure out what blocks I'm dividing up memory into. So questions about our arrangement so far? Okay, so now we know that if I have this address, I know it would be stored in index 1. But I have a problem here. I look in index 1 and I say, oh, I have a bunch of zeros. Can I just return that value? Well, there's two issues here. So one issue is that in this case, I haven't put anything in the cache yet. But the problem is my cache doesn't have any way of indicating that. So I need to add that. So I'm going to add a valid bit for each block. So I'm going to store one extra bit indicating, is there a value here? And if that's false, I know there's no value. Stop looking. We need to actually go to memory first. So if there isn't a value, what we'll do is we're going to go to memory and fetch the value. So in this case, I said, OK, I know it wants to go in index 1. I'm going to read this value from memory, and I'm going to load it into my cache, because I'm going to assume later on you're going to access something. You're going to access this again, or you're going to access something at a nearby address, like the AA. That's my assumption. That's why I'm putting it in my cache. But the problem is that if we read this again, I'm going to look at this value, and I don't know whether this BB here came from here or if it came from here, because both of those things could have been stored in our cache. So I need to store extra information to know where did this value I have cached come from. Right? It's not enough to know I have AABB from somewhere in memory. I need to know exactly which of the candidates it came from. And if you remember our diagram here, we have a bunch of places, including more below, where it could have come from. So to indicate that, I'm going to store some extra bits to indicate where it came from. I could store the whole address, but I'm going to take a shortcut, and I'm going to realize that I don't need to store the lowest bit, because that is always 0 to 1 for every block. I don't need to store the next two bits, because for everything in this row, this index, that's always 0, 1. So I don't need to store that. So I'm only going to store what's left over, which is the 0, 1 at the beginning. So that's what I'm going to store as my tag. So it's all the extra information I need to know. Where did this come from? And this is going to tell me that this BB here came from 01, 011, and not 00011. That's important because if the processor asks for one of those addresses, I don't want to return the wrong value. Yes? So let's say I were looking at the same index value but for two different arrays. Would this cache become less useful? And is your concern that those two arrays would map to the same row of the cache as we're accessing them? Yes? Yes. So that is a possibility. And we're going to have a cache design we're going to talk about after we talk about direct map caches, which is designed to handle that situation better. Yes? Okay, so first question is, what is the value valid? So a bunch of this cache, we haven't filled in yet. So for example, this index 0, we could cache these first two bytes here, we could cache these bytes, but we haven't chosen anything yet. So the valid bit being 0 is indicating that we haven't chosen anything yet. And in particular, I need that in addition to the tag, because the tag, well, I have to put something there. But it turns out I shouldn't be looking at the tag yet, because I haven't filled that in either. Does that answer that question? So your second question was, how did I get A, B, B here? And what happened in my scenario is the processor asked for me to read BB. And as part of reading that, I said, well, I'm guessing the processor is going to need that later, so I'm going to store that in the cache. And the only way we can store things in this cache is by storing whole blocks, so we store an AA with it. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? So this is sort of the basic design of a direct map cache, which is one of the simpler cache designs that we can have. As I alluded to, real processors do something, so a bit of an extension of this. This is still sort of the basics of how we organize a cache. So if we generalize this a bit, we can think of we have a bunch of rows, and we're going to divide up our address that we access memory at into a bunch of pieces. And we're going to call this middle piece the index. And that's going to tell us what row to go to. We're going to use that to access a row of our cache, which is going to have a valid bit, a tag, and some data. When we do this access, we're going to have to check, does the tag that's stored in the cache match the one from the address the processor is trying to access? That is, if this cache has data stored in it, in this block, is this block actually from the right same part of memory we're trying to look at? Or is it from some other part of memory that happens to share some bits in the address? So we're going to check if the tag matches, and we're also going to check if it's valid at all. Because if it's not, we haven't stored anything in this block yet, we don't want to use it. And if so, we have what's known as a cache hit. We're going to use the value from the cache. If this is not true, we're going to have to delay and talk to the next level or memory. So then we get some data. Now, here I have a bunch of bytes of data, but the processor is asking for a specific address, so we want to get that specific address. So we're going to need to do some work using the lower bits of the address to figure out which of these bytes of data you were referring to. So in this example, I have 4 bytes, and I'm going to choose which of the 4 bytes to return to the processor based on that. And I'm kind of glossing over that maybe in practice we want to return like 8 bytes in total to the processor, starting at the correct byte, but it's this process kind of repeated to do that. But we're going to have this lower part of the address, we're going to call the offset. It's going to tell us where in this block is the byte where the processor went. And in this case, it's the third one, index 2. So this is index 0, 1, 2, 3 of the block. And because we've chosen a power of 2 size for a block, we can always look at the bottom few bits to determine where in the block we're looking. So in this case, it's the bottom 2 bits because we have 4 bytes in a block, and the original example was the bottom 1 bit because we had 2 bytes in a block. But because we chose a power of 2 size, we just look at the bottom few bits, and that tells us which of the various bytes of the block we're looking for. Some questions? This sort of cache operation. And I guess I should also mention, to be explicit, because we have a power of 2 number of rows here, our index bits is also just a number of bits. We don't have to do division or anything. But we will deliberately choose a power of 2 number of rows to make that possible. Okay, so a piece of terminology. I refer to rows. The term you're going to see used for this is a set. And later on, we're going to change how much stuff is in a row. So the term for a row is a set. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of cache organizations we can have, and we have two big decisions. We have one decision with direct map caches. How big are our blocks? So how do we divide memory up into 2-byte pieces, into 4-byte pieces? We're going to divide it up into these power of two piece size pieces, starting at the beginning. But we can do like 2-byte pieces, 4-byte pieces, 8-byte pieces, all the way up as far as we want to go. And we can also choose how many rows, how many sets we have. And these choices are going to change how we divide up our address. So if we have 2-byte blocks, then we're going to have 1 byte for our offset. One bit for our offset. Because to figure out where in a block is this value, we can either say it's the first byte or the second byte. We need 1 bit to tell that information. So our bottom 1 bit of their address, or at least significant 1 bit, is going to say which byte in the block is it. And if we had, say, 4 bytes in a block, we're going to need 2 bits for that. Those 2 bits are going to tell us which of the 4 bytes in the block is it that we're looking for with this particular address. The rest of the address is going to be our tag and index, and it's going to tell us what row and where did that row come from of all the places it could have come from in memory. So if we have 2 rows, we'll need 1 bit. If we have 4 rows, we'll need 2 bits. And we'll just take the next bits of the address. So in this case, I am taking these 2 bits here are our index for the first case, because we already chopped off 1 bit for the offset. In the case of our last row on the table, we're taking that bit there because we've already chopped off the last 2 bits for the offset there. And for our remaining case, we need 3 bits for our offset. And these are going to be these 3 bits, because we've already chopped off 1 bit for, sorry, those three bits for the index, because we chopped off 1 bit for the offset already. And then whatever's left over is going to be our tag. So we'll always be able to take this tag, index, and offset and reconstruct the whole address. So this in particular means I can like look at some byte in this cache here and say, where did this come from in memory? So I could say, okay, we have this F1 here. This is offset 0 because it's the first byte of the block. This is index 001 because it's in that row. And its tag is 01 because that's what the value in the row is. So that came from 010010. That's the address it came from. So questions about how we're dividing up our addresses and how they correspond to what's stored where? Yes. Question of the actual place in memory is the tag plus the index plus the offset? Yes. So that's where the values are stored. Yeah, the original is stored in memory. And the tag and index offset by plus, we mean concatenated, not actual addition place. Other questions? Okay. So I've gone over sort of how we determine how many bits we have for offset, index, and tag, and what that sort of corresponds to in the cache. If you look at our textbook likes writing this as formulas, which is a fine way of doing it. I prefer to show the diagram just because this is how I like thinking about it, and because I think it's, you know, I think people, these formulas are useful, but our textbook often, but sorry, people following them often might not realize what's going on if you have to something which doesn't obviously apply to these formulas. There's one piece of terminology I would like to point out here, which is cache size. So when we refer to the size of a cache, the size we're referring to is the size of the data part of the cache. So we mean the size of this value part here. That is what we're referring to. Even though it's the case, the cache is storing additional information in the tag and invalid bits. And it turns out there will be some other bits of what we'll call metadata that's not going to be part of the cache size. The cache size is only going to be the amount of data the cache can store. And you can see these formulas correspond to what we were talking about. We said if we have so many set index bits, that means we have 2 to that number of sets. So we have 4 sets, we have 2 set index bits. 2 to the 2 is 4. If we have 8 byte blocks, our block size 8 is 2 to the number of offset bits. So 2 to the 3 is 8. That's how we correspond. So this all corresponds to what we were illustrating with that picture earlier, just in formula design. And we also have our tag is the number of bits in a memory address minus the size of our set index bits and our offset bits. Questions? Okay, so let's do a little exercise. So let's say I have a cache with 64 byte blocks and 128 sets. So this cache can store about 8 kilobytes of data. This is a more realistic, this is actually smaller than a typical L1 cache these days. It's in the right neighborhood for a typical L1 cache. And our question is, addresses are 32 bits, how many tag bits, how many index bits, and how many offset bits do we use when accessing this cache? And then there's a second part we'll get to after that. Well, who would like some more time? Not sure. Okay, everyone. Just for the first part, I mean. I'll do the second part later, but let's get started with the number of off segments. Just the number of off segments. Okay, so thinks we have one off segment, two off segments, three, four, five, six, seven. Eight or more, no clue. Okay, so we have pretty good consensus on six. And that's what I get. And why do I get six? Because 64 bytes is equal to 2^6. So if we're looking back at our sort of how the access works diagram, we're gonna have 64 inputs if we're finding the right byte here. And we're going to need to choose between those 64 things, 6 bits. Questions, how I figured that out? Okay, so let's go to next to index bits. Who thinks we have, let's start with four or less index bits? Four or less, five, six, seven. Okay, so we have pretty good consensus on seven. That's what I get. And it's the same kind of logic. We need to decide, if we look at our diagram, we need to decide which of these rows here we go to, and we have 128 of them. That's 2 to the 7th. So we need 7 bits to figure out which of those rows to go to. And note that these numbers were both powers of 2 because that's required for a direct map cache organization. They have to be powers of 2. We can't have a cache with this design with 70 byte blocks. That's not allowed. We can't have 130 sets. Not allowed. Okay, so how about tag bits? So can someone tell me how to compute the tag bits? Yeah. See, is it just the number of addresses minus those two numbers? Yes. So 32 minus 7 plus 6, which is 32 minus 13. And I probably should have had this calculated somewhere in advance, but hopefully that's 19. So we have 19 tag bits, and that is just, if we think of our address, we're just, you know, that's just what's left over after we account for the index and the offset. So questions? That. Okay, so let's do, I guess we have only a couple of minutes, so I'll give you a little time to look at the next part. And the way I would start this is I would first convert some of this to binary. So our last, this number, binary number ends with, looks like this in binary, the address. I just converted each hexadecimal digit to 4 bits, because that's how many bits it takes to write them exactly. And for time reasons, I know people probably, who thinks A is stored in the same block? Or more than one of these are correct, by the way. Thinks B is? Okay, C, D. Okay, so most people, we seem to have most of the agreement on B and C, a little less on A, and a lot less on D. And I think the correct answers are A, B, and C. And what we're looking for here is that for something to be in the same block, so meaning that when it's in the cache, they're part of the same thing that's stored together, everything but the offset bits have to be the same, right? The offset bits, how we decide between different parts of a block. So the question is, all this stuff up here the same? And that's true for these first two values. It's not true for, so it's true for 0x11, because when we bring in 0x37, we're going to bring in 0x11000. We're going to bring in, the addresses we're going to bring in include everything that starts with 10000, and then all zeros for the offset, all the way up to all ones for the offset. We're going to bring in the entire block, and that includes all the possible offsets. So that range of addresses is 0x1000 through 0x10F. Questions on how I figured that out? And the thing that confuses people a lot here, but to make clear, is that where the block starts is always offset 0. Doesn't matter if the first thing we access is in the middle, we always bring in the block starting at offset 0 because we have no way of indicating we only have like the set, we're starting at a different offset. We always start at offset 0. So we would bring in these values. Even though OX41 is close, we don't take advantage of it. It just has a different index, so it's not going to be stored together. Okay, that's where I'll leave off for today. We'll finish up looking at cache operation for direct map caches and talk about more advanced cache design next time.